Eleanor Swent continuing the interview with Vincent Perry on March 9th, 1990. All right, so you were, let me get this straight. These alluvial fans were coming down from a mountain that were to the west
to the west of us.
And the Walker River
was immediately to the east of us. In other words, we were on the west edge of the Walker River Valley. Yarrington is the community, the farming community in the center of the valley, a very rich little area of farms and ranches.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Weed didn't think that you could mine under a river?
Well, he didn't think we could mine under a river, and he certainly had a point. And another of the very questionable matters was that this fine showing of 2% copper was largely based upon sludge samples. The rock was so badly broken that our core recovery was inadequate, and we didn't have sample information that upon which we could rely. So we decided the first thing to do was to get more drilling done, and we moved a churn drill in, and also another diamond drill. And after putting down several holes, it was evident that we did have both economic thicknesses of oxide ore and underlying good grade sulfide mineralization. So I then suggested to New York that instead of depending upon the drill holes, where the recoveries were simply unsatisfactory, that we had to get down and sink a shaft and do some underground work to confirm what the drill holes had indicated. Not only that, by sinking the shaft, I could perhaps answer Mr. Weed's fears about the water problem. If we could handle water in an underground operation, certainly it could be handled in an open pit. So I asked...
You were intending an open pit.
We were intending an open pit because this was very shallow ore. We were within, in fact, the gravel thickness in some places was in the order of 10 or 20 feet.
So your shaft was only for exploration.
For exploration. And I asked that Alex McDonald, who I've mentioned before, he was the best man at my wedding and a close friend in the early days in Butte, and had done fine work there at the during the Depression and administering the company's efforts to feed and house people that were destitute because of the conditions in Butte. Alex had, in the meantime, gone into operations and was managing the Mayflower mine for the Anaconda Company in Montana. The Mayflower was a very high-grade gold mine, and it was a small operation, but it was being run very effectively and with high profit by McDonald. I asked the management in Butte if they could spare McDonald and have him come down to Yarrington and develop a mine for me. And, reluctantly, they agreed, and McDonald was transferred from the Mayflower mine under the Butte operation to the geological department at Yarrington. Alex sized the situation up, and he immediately devised a very practical, sensible plan. He said, let's drill four big churn drill holes, one in each corner of our proposed shaft, put deep well pumps on those holes, and just pump for all it's worth to see how far we can drop this water table, which is being, of course, influenced by the nearby Walker River. And Alex went ahead with this program, and he pumped many thousands of gallons of water a minute from each of the holes, and he was able to draw that water down. He said, if I can keep those pumps going and keep that water down, we can sink a shaft and follow the water table as we gradually reduce it through the wells.
What did you do with the water that you pumped? We went
back into the Walker River. And of course it was good water. It was there was no impurity in the water. It was good, clear, clean water. So the water was the water problem was tackled in that way, and a shaft crew from Butte was sent down, and they sunk a two-compartment exploration shaft under this head of water down about 300 feet. Levels were designed to be turned off in the center of the oxide zone and down in the sulfide zone. Those two levels were driven. Cross cuts were established and connected with the exploration drill holes, and raises were put up on each of the drill holes so that we had a perfect check on grade by sampling all the material that came out of each of those raises. The net result was that we knew we had a real ore reserve, and that this would be a mineable deposit. About the same time, there were concerns in Washington, D.C. about the deteriorating political problem in Korea, and it became increasingly evident that copper was going to be needed for another war period. So Washington was interested, and Anaconda negotiated with the War Production Board to get accelerated depreciation and that sort of economic help in bringing this deposit in rapidly. We'd decided to bring Bert Millar, who was an operator at Cananea, up to open design the pit and established Wilbur Jordan as the engineer to design the concentrator and the leaching plant. The idea was to leach the oxide ores and precipitate them and to concentrate the high-grade, the low-grade sulfide, and ship the concentrates to Anaconda. This was a real disappointment to my friend Alex McDonald, who wanted to continue as manager of the operation. I suppose this is one of the things that happens in a mining organization. It was Weed's judgment that Millar, a man with a lot of background and experience in open pit mining, would be better than McDonald at this sort of job. I'm not sure that that was right, but at any rate, it was a break for me because he assigned McDonald to me as my assistant, and I moved McDonald to Salt Lake with me, and we worked very closely together for the next few years in a lot of different mine examinations and exploration jobs.
I wanted to ask about choosing your assistants. How did you go about choosing the people that worked for you? Did you have authority to hire them?
Well, I had authority to hire them, and I was looking for men of intelligence, number one, but I also wanted men who were not only well-educated and knew how to use what they had learned, but men who were loyal and men who were trustworthy and with solid, sound principles. I had met so many good geologists in my first few years in Butte, Montana, that I naturally gravitated towards them, so that many of my selections were men that I had known and that I obtained from the Butte Department. They had already been through the training that was offered in Butte, and Butte, of course, was considered by the mining fraternity generally as a graduate school for mining geology. A lot of fine young men wanted to go to Butte simply to get that experience and training underground. So I was fortunate in being able to pick men of that caliber, but I did try to pick the men that had the best education. I, for instance, favored Ted Dodge because of his background at Harvard. I liked Bob Mailman because of his PhD credentials from Harvard. Men of that caliber I selected largely because of their intelligence along with their general character as men that I felt would be loyal and hard workers and good field men. I was certainly anxious to get men that were good in the field, because it was the field work that counted. That's where the facts were, and that's where we wanted men that could observe them and record them properly and analyze them correctly.
Did you ever go outside the Anaconda organization for people?
I can't recall offhand that I did, but I may have. Later on, of course, that was done after I retired. But during my time, I picked men in the Anaconda organization that were, I felt, had were tried and had company loyalty and had had company experience and had had experience particularly around some of the company properties. After all, looking for a mine, you want men that have had some experience with operating mines, that know something about the geology as it's exposed in a in an underground operation, and know how to use that sort of data, can work well with mine operators and provide an engineering approach to problems. I didn't want just plain theorists. I didn't have much use for them, although I was certainly respectful of their efforts and in many cases was very sympathetic with what they were trying to do. But for practical mine work, where it comes to the dollars and cents of applying geology to mining, you have to have basically an engineer's approach. You can't fool around with textbooks and university professors.
What about your relations with universities? Did you
Yes, I did. I maintained contact with the University of California, for example. But I was—I never actually recruited a geologist from the University of California. I had contacts with Stanford. I did recruit an outsider into the organization, graduate of Stanford, Tiny Lin, who was working for one of the companies in Mexico and had applied for a job, and I put him to work at Cananea.
Did you have professors coming around wanting to...
Well, yes, we had, particularly because of the new developments at Cananea, we were entertaining professors quite often. I had Grattan there for several days.
From Harvard?
From Grattan from Harvard. I had Bateman there. Butler from the University of Arizona, B.S. Butler. And there were others of that caliber that were interested and wanted to see Cananea. We were always anxious to show off and show them all the new geology and the new ideas. One of the interesting things about Grattan's visit was that Grattan in 1907 had been a young man on the team recruited by Dr. Lewis Ricketts to make a geological study of the new developments in Cananea. That was 1907, before any of this porphyry copper activity had been generated. And Grattan, with S.F. Emmons, made a geological map of the district. And one of the features that he had shown on that map was a large plug of, in fact, a very extensive area of what he called Henrietta diorite. Well, diorite, of course, is a deep-seated intrusive rock. And one of my first trips around the district, I spotted some of this so-called diorite, and it didn't look to me like a typical holocrystalline granitic rock at all. It looked to me like a volcanic. I had a petrographer from Columbia University out there, and I put him on our staff. A fellow by the name of Wilbur Valentine. He, again, that was another non-Anaconda man that I recruited for the staff. And he was a real clever, trained petrographer. He'd worked under Dr. Colony, one of the best in the business at Columbia. And he immediately said, Vin, he said, your field observations are correct. This is a volcanic rock. And I said, well, let's just remap it. So Valentine, who in addition to being a good petrographer was an excellent field man, started out and mapped the so-called Henrietta diorite, and we found that it was all volcanic, that it was lying unconformably upon the older sedimentary sequence, and that actually this identification of a rock as an extrusive rather than an intrusive made a world of difference in the whole pattern of the Cananea district. So when Grattan was down there, I said, Dr. Grattan, I said, I want to show you this old map that you made here. And I said, you mapped all of this as diorite. And I said, I can take you out in the field and we can take a look at some of it. And I want to know whether you still think it's diorite or whether you don't feel that our present interpretation that it is a volcanic rock is correct. So I took Grattan out and he looked these things over, these rocks, and made no comment. When he got back to the house, my wife had him to lunch, and sitting around the lunch table, I said, tell me now, what do you think about that diorite? And he said, I'll tell you. He said, I was an awfully young man when I made that map. So he admitted in a very nice, gentlemanly way that he was wrong.
Oh, he'd grown up.
He'd grown up.
Well, you have to.
But I found Grattan to be a very helpful and understanding geologist and a great man in the field. I spent several days with him, and he came up with a lot of good thoughts and ideas about Cananea geology, so that this was just something that we could laugh over.
In choosing assistants, then if it was a good student of Grattan's, you would have been...
Yes, I was always impressed with that. I thought that Grattan offered excellent courses at Harvard, and of course I had always, even back in my student days at Berkeley, I had been impressed with Don McLaughlin, and McLaughlin was Grattan's principal star. Grattan had been McLaughlin's mentor, and so I felt that anybody that came from Harvard, if he had the right attitude and was willing to work, why, we would could use them.
Did you consider their wives at all?
Oh, yes, we did, definitely. That was one of the reasons I was partial to Anaconda men, because I knew their wives and families, and I knew the kind of people they were and how they would adjust to mining camp life. It was very important. One other non-Anaconda man we had was a youngster from Caltech who was sent out there by Dr. Ricketts. Dr. Ricketts had in the meantime retired, was living in Pasadena. He was a very wealthy man. And he no doubt was a generous donor to Caltech, and he knew the staff pretty well. And so he sent out a man one summer to do some work in Cananea, and I remember I was going on a vacation, and my assistant Roland Mulkey was in charge. When I came back, I said, "Where is this man Cornwall that Ricketts sent out to Cananea to be a helper?" And Mulkey said, "I fired him." I said, "Why did you fire him?" He said, "He didn't know how to get in and work." It was that simple. Well, since then, Cornwall has developed into a rather well-known geologist and is one of the top senior men with the United States Geological Survey. So
yes.
Those are the kind of things that happen, and you don't...
The mistakes of youth.
Mistakes of youth,
mm-hmm.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
My assistant Mulkey was an unusual man, and I picked him right at the start when I went to Cananea, because I had great respect for his intelligence and for the work that he was doing in Butte. At that time he was a bachelor, but he was going around with a lovely girl who was then attending the University of Montana at Missoula. And I decided that Mulkey would be a fine man to support me in my efforts at Cananea. And I never regretted that. Mulkey always served me loyally and with a great deal of intelligence. He was never a yes man. We had many arguments. There were times when Mulkey and I were at complete opposite ends of the pole, but
about geology.
But I felt that a man that had the not only courage but ability to stand up and fight for his point is a man worth having around. And I remember one time in desperation saying to Mulkey, the trouble with you, Mull, is that you're so terribly prejudiced. And he said, tell me, what's wrong with a good, solid, well-founded prejudice? That's the kind of a fellow he was. But I owe so much to him because he had good ideas, and I adopted many of the things that he originally proposed, and which at first I looked upon with some question. I felt that he knew what he was talking about and he could prove it. And another thing about Mulkey that was always great was that he was always willing to do the roughest, toughest kind of work on these field examinations down in southern Sonora. Lots of times conditions were pretty tough down there. We had to have our own camps, and we had to carry our own provisions. We had to make arrangements for transportation, sometimes on horseback or muleback. And Mulkey was a great fellow there to organize a trip and have provisions adequate for the job. And he would tackle things that would require a good deal of skill and ability in the way of maybe shoring up the collar of an old shaft that we wanted to get down and study. And he knew how to get in there and put in a few timbers and build a windlass and tie the rope so that we could go down in safety. And he always wanted to do that himself. He wouldn't send one of his younger Mexican samplers down as a tryout. Mulkey always went down gave the windlass or whatever device or ladder that had been constructed to do the job a test with his own arms and legs before he asked any of his helpers to go down and do it. It showed to me that he always had real integrity in that sort of work. So I felt he was a great assistant, and and MacDonald again was the same type man. Tremendous courage and ability and loyalty and the kind of man you just like to be around and work with. One of my great losses was the fact that After a very few years in Salt Lake City, I noticed his health began to fail, and we made a trip down to San Francisco to a mining congress meeting. I had flown down, and Alex had driven his car from Salt Lake City. We got down there, and I thought that Alex looked very poorly at the meeting, and he wasn't the kind to do any quibbling about his ill health or anything of that kind. He'd always prided himself on his strength and ability and to get around and do the tough job. And he said, "Vin," he said, "would you mind if I flew back to Salt Lake City and you drive my car back?" And I said, "No, Alex, I'd be glad to do that. I wanted to stop anyway to look at a property near Ely." So I went back in his car, and while I was in Ely one night, my wife called and she said, "Vin, you'd better get back to Salt Lake as fast as you can. Alex is not well." So I went back the next morning and I found Alex in the hospital, and he died a few days later from Hodgkin's disease.
Oh my.
It was that quick. So I lost a great assistant there.
Who became your assistant after that,
then? About that time, I moved to New York within a short time, and Mike Kildale, who had been the geologist for International Smelting and Refining, took over the office for a couple of months, and then I asked Roland Mulkey, who had been my assistant at Cananea, and who I had moved out to Tucson to head our exploration office in Tucson, to come up and take over my position in Salt Lake City. Mm-hmm. And Mulkey was, in effect, the chief geologist there in our Western activities from then on, while I was in New York. And then I had the problem of getting an assistant eventually in New York, and that brought me into a whole new area involving the international activities that Anaconda was engaged in throughout Latin America and Canada.
We haven't gotten into the Latin American things at all.
No, not at all. This might be a good start to do it.
Well, I wanted to ask a couple more questions about Yerington.
All right.
Did you run into any opposition from these farmers whose lovely farms you were?
Well, we didn't hurt the farms. We worked, and MacDonald was largely responsible for this. During the time when we were doing this shaft sinking and all, he made many friends in around Yerington, and they respected. He was the company representative and a splendid one, and they were in favor of Anaconda's activities in its farming area, which was a kind of a new twist, because you don't find that very often. But MacDonald had that quality of meeting people. His wife was a very friendly person, and she knew the wives of different ranchers and farmers around the Yerington Valley area, and we had a fine community relationship It was just great the way Yerington worked.
They didn't mind your lowering the water table?
No, it didn't hurt the water table. That the flow of the Walker River was so great that we lowered a water cone, actually, rather than a table, because any time we let up pumping, we'd have been flooded out.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, there's one interesting story about that. After we had done, practically finished all of the underground, preliminary underground exploration activity, I made a trip out there to get a last good look at what had been exposed at some of the most distant crosscuts. There was one particular place where we had intersected a wide zone of chalcopyrite stringers that had averaged 2% copper, and I wanted to see how persistent they were and whether they were unduly influencing the weight that we had put on assays in that general area. So I was lowered in the skip and got off on the 200 level, and I had my notebook and tape, and I went back there and was carefully mapping these tiny veinlets of chalcopyrite. And Alex MacDonald, who of course knew that there was a risk because of the water, had stayed back at the shaft to see that there were facilities for us getting out if we had to get out in a hurry. And he came rushing back into this crosscut saying, "Vin, we'd better get out." He said, "There's the pumps are just not quite ready to take it." And he said, they may shut down. So I rushed out, and sure enough, by the time we got out to that shaft, the water was up to our chests.
Oh, my.
And we got into that skip and were hoisted up to the top just before the water would have engulfed us at that particular time. There were surges of water that had come in. It was a real wet, saturated country. And that water was never really controlled until the pit itself was opened up. And the succeeding general manager, Millar, had put in a lot of pumps around the periphery of the pit itself. And he was pumping on a grand scale, on a grander scale than we had done when we were just sinking the exploration shaft. And that water was always going into the Walker River, and I suppose the extra supply of water was welcomed by the farmers. It just added to the volume of the West Walker, which was a source of irrigation water for that valley clear down past Fallon. So water was really an asset there in a way, rather than a liability, as long as you could handle it.
And you weren't smelting or anything?
No, we never smelted there, no. No, we shipped all the concentrates, and the only copper production was from the oxide plant. We had a oxide plant that produced copper sulfate, and the copper sulfate was precipitated on I think it was an electrolytic plant, as I recall. Precipitated electrolytically.
That was no
pollution of any kind involved there. Our only difficulty with any of the farmers was when we came to negotiate to get some of their land where we needed surface for dumps and tailings disposal. And they were pretty smart Italian farmers, and they didn't want to give a big company any kind of a bargain, and of course you couldn't blame them. But there was some land that we simply couldn't get hold of because the prices were too high. We always managed, we had enough room there, so we always managed to get the ground we needed.
You weren't actually mining on what had been farms?
Oh, no, no. The alluvial gravel, you see, was not farmland.
No.
The farmland was all down at in the river bottom, where the soil had accumulated. But there were places where we needed ground for tailings disposal, where we had to reach out into some of this area that was usually sagebrush covered, but it was land that had probably some agricultural value. It wasn't first-class agricultural land. And of course, I've felt that there's still copper to be found in the Yerington area. There's as much of that country remains under cover. A lot of it under a very difficult cover. It's covered by hard volcanic rocks, and difficult to drill through because the rocks often are vuggy and are not particularly easy on a diamond drill bit. We did a lot of exploration actually there, and we had some attractive showings, but with the changes in Anaconda management in recent years, Atlantic Richfield apparently was not anxious to tackle that sort of a job, and the ground has been disposed of. I don't know who has it now. It's something that if the old Anaconda group was doing the job would certainly be under additional exploration and development.
I believe you said that you were at Yerington when you heard of Pearl Harbor?
No.
No, the fall of Poland.
No, the fall of Poland when we were driving from Los Angeles to Salt Lake City. Mm-hmm. And the word came over the radio in my automobile that Hitler was invading Poland. September 1st, 1939, we arrived that day in Salt Lake City. And I thought to myself, here's World War I all over again. And it's going to affect the lives of all of us, and it certainly did. Mm-hmm. Now, I was on December 7th, Pearl Harbor incident was reported on a Sunday afternoon after I had spent a hard day's work. We're going underground early Sunday morning and mapping geology all day long in the old Shoshone mine near Death Valley. And I came up that night and to get my evening meal, and I sat down at the boarding house and I saw the looks of frustration and excitement in the face of these miners, and I said, what's happened? And somebody said, haven't you heard the news? And I said, no, I've been working all day. Well, the radio has been full of it all day. Pearl Harbor has been attacked and destroyed. U.S. fleet destroyed. And I rode down to Furnace Creek to a pay station down there in Death Valley and put in a call to Margaret in Salt Lake City, asking her what she knew about this story I was getting out in this isolated mining camp. And she said, every bit of it is true. And I said, well, I'll be back tomorrow morning. And I started driving right that day and drove right through to Salt Lake City.
What changes did it mean in your professional life?
Well, I thought I'd better get in the service. And then I began to think of my age, and I suggested this to Weed, and he said, absolutely not. He said, you're going to be of much more use to the war effort by doing this work with Anaconda and trying to develop some metal resources for the war effort. And he said, you better stay right where you are. And after thinking it over for a few days, I decided to do that, although my brother and I had quite a discussion about that, and he went into the, volunteered for the Navy, and was put in charge of he got his commission and was put in charge of a minesweeper out here off the California coast. Of course, at that time we figured we were going to be invaded at any time.
Yeah. Where was your brother living at the time?
He was living in Los Angeles.
I see.
And I went down to, while this discussion about going into the service was going on, I went down to see him. He had a home in Santa Monica, and about 2 o'clock in the morning we heard this, all these explosions and terrible noise, and woke up and the sky was just ablaze with lights and flames and flashes. Mm-hmm. And the story was coming in over the radio that the Japanese fleet was off San Pedro and we were being invaded. We all got up partly in our night clothes and went out in the street to see this scene, and were certainly awestruck by what was happening, just as all our neighbors were. We came back, and I remember the fear and panic that had engulfed all of us. My sister-in-law, Frank's wife, and their four little children, and I all got into the same bed for mutual warmth and protection. We were all shivering.
Terrified.
Mm-hmm. And the next morning, I woke up to find the Los Angeles Times somewhat sheepishly admitting that everybody had been hoodwinked, that this had been a false show put on by the U.S. Army off Palo Verde to awake the general public in the Los Angeles area to the war, the fact the war was on, but there was no basis for it at all. And yet the San Francisco, the Los Angeles Examiner had carried a story saying that Japanese plane reported to have been shot down at Figueroa and some intersecting street in Los Angeles.
I had never heard that.
Well,
no.
That's true. That happened in Los Angeles, sure.
The army had just
faked it to arouse the people to the fact that a war was on. And looking back at it, I can see that maybe they had a point. A lot of people were pretty much unaware of the importance of the Pearl Harbor event, and maybe word had gone out from the administration in Washington to do anything that would stir up public hostility to what the Japanese had done. It was shortly after that they started rounding up all the Japanese citizens here in California and putting them out in camps in Nevada. These were all things that I think were probably motivated by the certain people in the administration in Washington to stir up war hysteria. I know there was no question about my brother's attitude. He was enlisting the next morning to get out and man a torpedo boat out here to protect the California coast. But I went back to Salt Lake, and I didn't go in the service, but I felt that I was doing something useful, I think probably it was just as wise a decision as you could make, because I did spend a lot of time then in Chile, and I could see firsthand the role that Chile was playing in the war effort. That copper was absolutely indispensable to the carrying on the kind of things that were necessary in manufacturing and shipbuilding and all that made America's industry probably the critical thing in turning the results of the war in favor of the Allies. I think that the Roosevelt administration saw this, and I think they probably had it figured out about right. I contributed to the early end of the war, along, of course, with the atomic bomb. Those are terrible things, but that's what war results in. Terrible things that we hate to face in peacetime, but are there when the situation deteriorates to the extent when you find yourself at war.
You said you first went to Chile in 1944.
Yes, I made my first trip to Chile in 1944, and it was under the under war regulations.
How did you get there?
Well, we went by train to Florida.
Who is we?
Reno Sales and myself, and we took the old China Clipper out of Florida. It was one of my first experiences with a real international flying trip. The old China Clipper was blacked out entirely, and made its run down Biscayne Bay in absolute darkness, and I wondered how in the world it was going to miss all of the little ships and yachts and motorboats that I'd seen scattered around the bay that afternoon. It seemed to me, at least half an hour for it to get airlifted. It just chugged on and on through that water, trying to gain enough momentum and to become airborne. Finally, was in the air. We were seated in bucket seats in a baggage area, and there were probably about 20 or 30 passengers, most of them in one way or another participating in some war work and trying to get to South America. And we landed at the canal and spent that day around the canal, stayed at the old Tivoli Hotel, which was all blacked out, and we were told that to be dressed and ready at 3 o'clock in the morning to take a plane to Ecuador. We were up at 3 o'clock. We had tiny little flashlights that we used to dress and assemble our baggage, and took off in a DC-2 to Guayaquil in Colombia. Landed at Guayaquil, and where is Guayaquil in Ecuador? I'm not sure now.
I think it's Ecuador.
It is Ecuador, yes. Then flew by short jumps to Lima. There were probably 4 or 5 stops along the coast getting to Lima, and then after a day of layover in Lima, we picked up the flight and went to Arequipa, then to Arica, and then to Iquique, and then to Antofagasta, and then finally landed at Barquito. At Barquito, we were entertained by the Saunders, who were Mr. Walter Saunders was the company representative and engineer at Barquito, and in charge of the newly built railroad up to the Puerto Rios mine. He loaded us on a track car that day, and we went on up to the mine, and our assignment was to make a thorough estimate of available reserves and revise any ore reserve blocks that possibly could be brought into the picture at an earlier date to enhance the amount of copper that Puerto Rios could produce for the War Production Board.
It was already in production.
It was in production, yes.
And Chuqui also.
And Chuqui was also in production.
Chuqui was older.
Chuqui was older, yes. But one of the things that both Sales and I asked was, so what about areas around Puerto Rios? Shouldn't we get into the exploration business? Well, question there was, can you get into the exploration business and do any good for the war? That time was so essential to this problem that the 100% of the effort should be concentrated on getting production out just as fast as you could. At any rate, we studied what geological information was available. At that time, Walter March was chief geologist at Puerto Rios. He was one of the men who I knew in Butte and had been sent down there by Reno Sales to organize a geological department several years before. And he had done some mapping and had some ideas about outside property. So at least on Sunday, we felt that instead of playing golf, we had the right to, on our own time, to go out and look at some of the exploration bets. So we took a picnic lunch and went out north of Puerto Rios, about 15 or 20 miles, to a place called the camp area. And the camp area had a very juicy looking show of chrysocolla outcropping at the surface. But it was a very limited sort of a thing. You could see the outcrops around and you could see how this good mineralization seemed to fade out, and that there was a good possibility that it was just a small lenticular restricted zone of copper and maybe nothing that would develop into a mine. However, while we were eating lunch, looking around the general area on that high 12 to 14,000 feet elevation country in the Altiplano, where you could see as far as you wanted to, I was impressed with a reddish peak in the distance behind our picnic spot, and I thought that just as a way of maybe aiding my digestion, it would be worthwhile to walk over in that general direction and see what that red peak really meant, looked like close at hand. So I started over there alone and got over there in an hour or so and began picking around, and I was very much impressed with the nature of the alteration and the fact that there were those same little tiny quartz veinlets that had first enthralled me when I started mapping over the great La Colorada ore body at Cananea. And so I came back and I asked Walter March about this area, and he confirmed that they had been over there and had done some reconnoitering, and he said yes. He said there's probably a prospect there, but he said it looks like a very long-range sort of thing and not the kind of thing we want to do right now. At least the management doesn't want to do it. So we came back and talked to the general manager, Mr. Greniger, and he said, I know there's a prospect over there. He said, as a matter of fact, he said, the company already owns it. He said, I've seen that that ground was covered with claims, but he said, we're not going to go over there and explore now. He said, we've got our hands full with our operation. So I was a bit disappointed that nobody saw anything attractive for the immediate future in my observations of the Indio Muerto Peak, which is what it was called. And I had that very much in mind when I came back to the United States. When I came back to Salt Lake, I decided... Oh, all right.